Welcome to January's Radio Wild. It's our first episode of the new year, and Chris and I have an interesting program lined up for you today. Normally, we host a show on the first Monday of the month. However, I had lost my voice and was feeling under the weather at the time. So for those of you who were anxiously awaiting this broadcast, we apologize for the delay.
2015 was an exciting year for us. We've been championing the work of individuals across a spectrum of wildlife-related issues in our ongoing film series called The Great Predator Debate. We produced a film featuring regional experts who are on the front lines of dealing with apex predators such as bears, cougars, and wolves. The film's title is The Great Predator Debate, A Nation's Dilemma, and it focuses on key issues that our nation is facing related to the intersection of humans and large carnivores. I'm excited to announce that our film is in its final throes, and you will soon be able to watch it.
We've seen the final cut of the film, and folks, it's good. Never before has this issue been explored in the way this film does. It is truly a remarkable film that delves into some of the most important issues in wildlife conservation today, and most importantly, how we as humans will learn to live with wildlife, or live without it. We see it as a template for managing not just predators, but conflict.
Today we're continuing our Great Predator Debate series, and we're interviewing Rob Clavins from Oregon Wild. He's on the pulse of today's wildlife-related issues, not only in Oregon, but the entire Pacific Northwest. We're looking forward to hearing what he has to say.
But first, let's take a moment to hear from our sponsors for today's show. This episode is brought to you by Oregon Wild. Founded in 1974, Oregon Wild has been instrumental in securing permanent legislative protection for some of Oregon's most precious landscapes, including nearly 1.7 million acres of wilderness, 95,000 acres of forest, and almost 1,800 miles of wild and scenic rivers.
As a leader in the national grassroots campaign for conservation and roadless areas in our national forests, Oregon Wild helped secure administrative protections for more than 58 million acres of spectacular roadless areas across this great country.
We often hear from people asking us how they can get involved with wildlife. One of the best ways is to volunteer for an organization nearest to you and get involved with what they're doing. Organizations like ours are always looking for help from people like you. It's one of the most effective ways to directly benefit wildlife near you. Volunteer with the Wolf Center by visiting our website, wolfcenter.org.
And it's an important aspect to learning more about the natural world around all of us. Today, Alan and I are excited to talk with Rob Clavins of Oregon Wild. He has been a leading voice for wildlife here in the Pacific Northwest, and it's great to have him on the show. Thanks, Rob, for joining us today and for all you do for our wild places and our wild creatures.
A world without four-legged predators is a very different one.
Rob, the question of the day is this. Is it possible for humans to successfully share this vast landscape of North America with large carnivores?
It's a big question, for sure. And certainly I think there's some things about it that are unique to here in the United States, and then certainly I think some things are more universal to human nature. You know, we haven't always been good at sharing the landscape with wildlife. I think that's always been something that we've struggled with. And certainly in America, we have a pretty unique history with settlement. You know, we had the Manifest Destiny, and certainly sort of a old school biblical Genesis style of, you know, the land belongs to us and we should tame it, and the wild is dangerous and it's evil and it's uncontrollable. Versus, I think we've sort of seen a evolution over time of understanding that there were limits to the frontier, that there are limits.
Can you elaborate on what you think those limits are? What do you mean exactly?
Yeah, I think, you know, we found out that there are limits to the frontier. There are limits to natural systems. You know, we've come a long way since we started trying to sanitize the landscape of anything that we perceived as a threat or anything that was uncontrollable. And again, I think we kind of ran into some natural limits of systems. And for that matter, started to see the value of wild places that include wildlife. You know, I've heard it said once, and it might be overstating it a bit, that without without predators, without wildlife, you know, wilderness is just scenery. And you know, I think there's something to that. I think having a landscape like this with bears and cougars and wolves makes for a much richer experience than you know, just going to a game farm or going to the zoo or going to some sanitized landscape.
You bring up a great point. It's important that we have a landscape that is suitable for predators. How do you think our development of the land has affected things? Do you feel it has?
So I think our development, it was, you know, early on, while the wild was a challenge to overcome. You know, we wanted to clear land for pasture, and then once we did that and introduced our grazing animals, we wanted to protect them from anything else that might want to eat them. You know, we developed the country rightfully. We had to build roads and we had to cut down trees to build houses. But I'm probably reiterating the same things I've said a million times before. And specifically with predators, though, I think that there's a number of reasons why predators are difficult for us to live with, are difficult for a lot of people to accept. Somewhere in our DNA, you know, we've been prey for a long time of our evolution, and so there's something deeply ingrained in us that I think can be fearful of predators. We see them as competition, and we did have to compete with them for food when we were scavengers. And so, you know, not to go too far back in time, but I think that certainly there's some of that. And then certainly in today's world, there's a feeling of you know, wanting control. And do we see the landscape as something that we want, within which we want to, you know, we want to coexist with wildlife, we want to live within natural systems, let nature take its course in some places, or have some parts of the landscape that may be wild, versus wanting to control and actively manage every square inch of it. And for people, I think, who want to see the more sanitized version of a landscape, predators are a challenge.
Rob, how do you feel that our worldview plays into these outcomes and our collective attitudes toward wildlife? And is it fair to paint certain worldviews as anti or pro wildlife? Is that productive?
Right. No, I think so. And I think, you know, I hope I didn't come off as sounding anti-religious or anti-Christian. That's certainly, I hope that's not what, you know, Rob Clavin's activist atheist, not my goal. I think there is sort of a dichotomy of people who, you know, you can't let nature run wild. You know, you've got to control everything. We want to have this sanitized landscape versus, I think, what you just said. There's a flip side to that, which is, coexisting with native wildlife and healthy landscapes isn't an onerous burden. It's a responsibility that we all share. And as the animal that can actually make choices and plan ahead and think, maybe we have a responsibility to future generations, to other living things with which we share this planet, to be good stewards.
Do you feel there's a limit in all of this, or have we passed some off-ramp with regard to our wild places, or are you actually hopeful?
You know, living in the 21st century where we are pushing natural systems to their breaking point, I think it actually, it's become getting to a point of self-interest as well. It's not just about, you know, necessarily about sort of spiritual or existence values, which are very important. And actually, I think sometimes I'm frustrated that we only talk about the value of nature and wildlife and trees and ecosystem services as services. We talk about them to the extent they have value to us as, you know, economic value because of extraction, or as recreation or wildlife viewing or those sorts of things that are all things we should talk about, or even understandable, quantifiable things like in ecology and science that are all very important. And we often skip over some of those just basic, more fundamental, whether it's spiritual value or just intrinsic value, which for, I think, most people understand, native wildlife have value. And just because something has pointy teeth, just because it scares us, just because it was in a fairy tale that we grew up being scared of, just because we see them as competition or part of a broader political issue that divides liberal elite from salt of the earth, rural communities, or these sorts of things, wildlife have value. I think those mountains have value, even if we can't strip mine them for coal or you know, clear cut them and turn those into 2x4s. There's a lot of value to that place, and I think that's something we all generally agree on. And I think we often overlook that in the conversation, and I've gone a long way from answering your question.
Do you think people just assume wildlife or wild places will always be there? They see the world as it is, trees, flowers, birds, etc. And do you feel like people are capable of making differences or understanding wildlife better?
I think so. You know, one thing that's kind of interesting is sometimes I feel like we take it for granted. You know, actually, I mean, sometimes I'm disappointed, as we talked about earlier. You know, I used to teach outdoor education, and talking to kids who lived in Portland were 15 years old, they'd never seen the ocean before. I know people my age who have lived in Oregon their whole life, they've never seen Crater Lake. You know, and they see the ad that says, you know, I won't go there. You know, I think that a lot of people take this stuff for granted wherever they may live. And what I think actually is amazing in a place like Oregon, and really special and something that we should value, is public lands and public values. And wildlife don't just belong to those of us lucky enough to live in a place like this. Public lands belong to all Americans. And I think that that's something that is important to recognize.
The issue of public lands is quite a hot topic these days. Do you find that people care about our public lands, or do you think people would rather see the wild tamed?
You know, if you want to go to a place that has paved roads and no animals with pointy teeth, you can go to New Jersey, you can go to LA, you can go to Portland, and those are great places for different things. But, you know, a place like this, I think is pretty special, and it's not because of roads. It's not because it's because there's something else there. And maybe it's just the view that you like, but maybe also it is that, you know, the opportunity to go hiking in the Eagle Cap Wilderness and to hear the howl of a wolf, to see the tracks of a bear or a cougar. And maybe that does scare you a little bit. I think we should be rational about those sorts of fears, but maybe, you know, maybe there's something to that. But I think that there is value to having that sort of wild. And you know, we've done a good job of developing the landscape, and I think it's important to protect what wild places remain. If in 2015 a place is still wild, maybe we ought to keep it that way, because there are a lot of places that aren't that way. And even in a place like Wallowa County, quite frankly, you know, there's a lot of roads, there's a lot of houses, there's a lot of development.
It seems there are more and more conflicts with large carnivores. Lately, during the filming of the Great Predator debate, Rich Beausoleil, who's the Washington State Carnivore Manager, said that residential maps suggest that Washingtonians can't travel 20 miles without crossing other humans. Is this a problem for carnivores in Oregon also? And do you think that these predators are capable of thriving in that situation?
But you know, if wolves and bears and cougars can't exist in Wallowa County, where can they exist in Oregon? Are we just going to say that, you know, we're not going to have wild, you know, we can't just let nature run wild, so we're not going to have, you know, we're not going to have animals that people see as controversial or as a threat, or we're just going to have them in these isolated pockets like Yellowstone National Park and Crater Lake and maybe in Hell's Canyon, and as soon as they cross those boundaries, then they're on our land and we're going to manage and control them. And unfortunately, I think, going to a slightly different place, unfortunately, I think a lot of the decisions we make are based on politics, they're based on emotions, they're based on sort of tribalism, rather than actually being based on reality. And so, sure, don't get me wrong, I see a cougar, I'm going to treat that thing with respect. I see a bear or a wolf, I'm going to treat it with respect. They have the tools to kill animals much bigger than me. They do it for a living. But the reality is, they don't. You know, as a general rule, there's a lot more to be concerned about driving to the trailhead than there is if you encounter a wolf. I say it not flippantly, but people say, what should you do when you see a wolf? And my answer, and a lot of answers of people who know wolves well, is grab your camera because you're really, really lucky. And it's not going to be there for very long. All sorts of stories of people from, you know, and I've had my own interactions with wolves where the alpha male of the Imnaha pack, yards away, came to find later on we were not far from the den site where there were probably pups. Here's an animal that has every justified right to kill me. And it ran away as soon as it saw me, tucked its tail under its leg, and ran away. You know, I think the statistic is there's been 2 people killed by healthy wild wolves in the North American continent since 1900.
What about cougars?
As far as I know, and I'd want to fact check this later, no one has ever been killed by a cougar, or I don't think even attacked by a cougar in Oregon since the state was founded. So sure, we might be afraid of them, but do we really need to be killing every cougar that we see? Do we need to be killing every wolf because we're afraid of them? It'd be nice if we could have conversations based on the real facts. And, you know, we can have a debate from those facts and come to a different conclusion. You know, but if you want to go have a picnic, and you can't agree whether it's sunny outside or it's raining outside, it's hard to come to even have a conversation about it. But if we can at least agree on the weather, you can still argue to not have that picnic. I can say have the picnic. That's probably nothing related to predators. But, you know, I think it's important to recognize legitimate concerns that people have, but also to make sure that we're putting them in context. If we're talking about human safety, you should treat those animals with respect, but there's a lot more to be afraid of than wolves and bears and cougars out there. For that matter, when it comes to the livestock industry, there were two cows confirmed killed by wolves last year in the whole state of Oregon. There were more cows killed than that by a single car accident a couple weeks ago. There's all sorts of statistics to put that in context. So.
We certainly know there are losses due to predators. What are your thoughts about the concerns of ranchers toward dealing with those losses? In your experience, are their concerns well-founded or are they perpetuated by some type of myth?
It's important not to be dismissive of legitimate concerns that people have, but it's important to, I think, keep those concerns in context. The livestock industry has a lot more to be concerned about of the price of land, of commodity prices, of competition from Argentinian beef than they do from the 51 adult wolves running around the state right now. It also just comes down to, what is an appropriate, what's the right solution? To some of our development, in a 19th century mindset, we killed Native Americans, we killed Native wildlife, and that was what we did. In the 20th century, we did a bit of a course correction. We had the Endangered Species Act.
And what precisely did the ESA do?
We said we're no longer going to purposely make species go extinct anymore. And now in the 21st century, we're trying to get it right. And I don't think it's clear, are we going to repeat the mistakes of the past, or are we going to try to do something different? And the old way of dealing with wildlife like predators and predators like wolves and cougars is pick up the gun, put out the trap, put out the poison. And that's why we eliminated wolves. That's why we don't have grizzly bear in this county anymore. Certainly there's sort of a simple way of doing things. It's the way it was always done. It's sort of like scratching a mosquito bite. It's cathartic. It makes you feel better. It feels like you solved the problem. But science is showing us that in many cases, that's not the best way to solve the problem. In many cases, you make it worse. We've been trying to kill coyotes for over 100 years, and all we've done is increase the population and the range of coyotes.
What about the regards to cougars, though? They can be a problem at times as well.
There's really good science to say that if you've got a cougar that's not hurting your livestock, keep it there, because that's your best cougar defense is that cougar that's going to defend that territory. Recent science came out of Washington State University that wasn't novel. There's actually been a lot of science that says this, that when you manage elk, you kill elk, you reduce the, you know, you kill an elk, there's one less elk, that's how you control the population. It's not so simple with an animal like a wolf that has this complex social structure. If you just randomly kill wolves across the landscape like they're doing with recreational hunting and trapping in places like Idaho and Wyoming, you can actually cause more problems than you're trying to solve, because you might be getting rid of the provider of that pack, and now you've got young, inexperienced wolves that don't know better. You might actually reduce the size of a pack's territory, so you have more wolves actually in a geographical area than you would have had before. And you see this with all sorts of other wildlife. That sometimes the easiest, simplest, most cathartic solution isn't a solution at all. And so, I think it behooves us in the 21st century to try to prioritize non-lethal conflict prevention. If we can implement changes to husbandry I should be clear, I'm not a rancher, I'm not a livestock expert, but there are a lot of people who are doing really responsible folks who are trying new things. Not everything works. Not everything works in all places. Not everything solves every problem. I'm sure there's some way of saying there's nothing solves everything, but something can, something like that, I'm sure. But responsibly implemented, those non-lethal tools can really go a long way in reducing unnecessary conflict, and actually solves all sorts of other problems. If you're checking your livestock more frequently, you're going to find your animals that are injured or sick, and be able to take them off and to get them whatever, to bring them back to health. Anyway, there's a lot of other benefits to it as well, not just necessarily reducing conflict. And to be fair, there's a learning curve there for a lot of folks.
Rob, what's your opinion on how we've learned to deal with wolves and other predators? Share your views on how the public should approach this discussion.
When it comes to wolves in Oregon, prior to 1947, it was really easy to solve the problem. pick up the gun, shoot the wolf. After 1947, it was even easier. We didn't even have wolves. And now we have wolves back on the landscape, and we're saying, well, they're endangered, and while they're recovering, we should think before we do that. We should prioritize conservation, and so we should be coexisting. And that's difficult. That means that some things are going to have to change. But again, I think it's important to provide some context. And, you know, whether it's cattle rustlers, people stealing cattle because the price of cattle is up, whether it's trucks, whether it's poison, whether it's birthing problems, disease, you know, wolves barely even register. Certainly if it's your cow, you know, that got killed, it's like if your sister gets hit by lightning, it doesn't make you feel better to hear. Not many people get hit by lightning because it's your sister. Likewise, if your cow is the animal that got killed, you know, that's meaningful to you, and we shouldn't just dismiss that because it's such a tiny percentage. But again, I think there's things we can do to prevent that.
Well, that just about wraps up our show for today. We want to thank Rob for taking his time to do this interview with us for the Great Predator Debate. I hope you guys enjoyed the show. Just kind of wanted to give you a quick update on the film that I'm producing. It's called Gray Area, Wolves of the Southwest. We are in the midst of our editing process right now, in the thick of looking through all of our transcripts from all the interviews and all the different little segments that we filmed when we were out in Arizona and New Mexico. And it's been quite a fun and interesting learning experience for me. But it's also been very fascinating delving into the process and seeing what production is like behind the scenes and reading all the different points that all of our different characters make for the film. It's really exciting, and I just can't wait to actually show the film so that every one of you guys can see where all of your donations and stuff have gone to help this film. So in the meantime, just continue to stay updated. Look for the Great Predator Debate that's going to be released here this week. And then also remember to tune in at the beginning of the first Monday of every month and for our next episode of Radio Wild. To join us next month, it's part two of this interview with Rob Clavins. We are looking forward to hearing more about what Rob has to say in the next episode about predators and how we can resolve different types of conflicts with predators. So be sure to tune in next month when we talk with him in episode two. We would love to hear your feedback regarding today's program of Radio Wild. Go onto our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/wolfcenter, and leave a comment in the comments section. For more information about Radio Wild, or to learn more about wolves at the Wolf Center, please log on to our website at www.wolfcenter.org and check out the Learn tab. And there's plenty of fun, exciting things for you to discover. Before we sign off today, we wanted to leave you with a short segment of next episode with Rob Clavins. It's a pretty interesting little dialogue that he has here, and so we wanted to share that with you to kind of give you an idea of what our next episode is going to be. So, enjoy it, and we'll see you next time.
You know, and for the sake of sound bites, it's often, things get oversimplified. And so there may be a perception that, you know, for instance, with the study out of Yellowstone, just add wolves, everything gets better. It's not quite that, you know, magically simple. It's very complex. And over time, I think we're starting to learn more and more. And all of these different parts of the ecosystem and the landscape, whether it's plants and amphibians and weather and climate and geology and chemistry, are all interacting with each other. So we shouldn't necessarily assume that we can just do X and expect Y to happen. That's just not the way it works. But I think it behooves us to study it, to try to learn as much as we can, to try to understand it as best we can. But going back to it, to have a little bit of humility, to understand that that what we know right now might not be the right answer, and we might know something better down the road. And if we're gonna have a default, if we're gonna err on one side or the other, I'd argue deferring to what nature has created for millennia before we got here and started tinkering with it. And certainly that doesn't mean we should take a total hands-off approach everywhere. That's just not, you know, whether maybe that is the answer, but it's certainly not a practical answer. That's not what we're going to do in the 21st century. We don't have to make this choice between living in a dark cave, cowering from, you know, from ravenous wolves, or living in cush space age apartments where we push buttons and the right, you know, food comes out in, you know, Soylent Green or whatever. Wow, went really off track on that. But, you know, anyway, so, you know, I think, yeah, so what are we learning? You know, and so as we learn, we also do have to understand that one of the big things are the impacts that we're having on the landscape. We're not separate from nature, but we certainly have a disproportionate impact, and we certainly have this ability to make decisions in a way other animals can't, or other parts of the ecosystem can't, to think ahead, to think about the consequences, to try to aim and steer towards different outcomes. But we've altered the landscape significantly. There's no doubt about that. But I think there's still room in the West, and there's still room in this on this earth for the animals that belong here. Whether you believe that God placed them here, or they evolved, or whatever your belief system is, they're here, and I think there's still a place for that. Even you look at this landscape around us. This is a tremendously beautiful place, but we've altered a lot of it. You know, you can see straight lines behind me where trees end and fields start, and there's roads and all that sort of thing. There's big fences in a lot of places to keep the elk out, so they're not eating our stuff. So we've definitely altered that landscape, and we can continue to do that. We can double down on that and call it progress and call it, you know, economic, you know, call it the path to prosperity, or we can I'm going to repeat myself again. What I'm trying to actually kind of think about, for whatever it's worth, is because I know that there is a counter narrative to a lot of this, and I'm sure you heard a lot of it from Todd. I wonder if I can just kind of speak off the cuff, and if I say something. No, you can record it. If I say something really inflammatory, can I just trust that?
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. We don't go that direction in this.
No. Sure. So I think there's a perspective of like, you know, we don't want to kill all the wolves. We don't want to kill everything. We just want to protect our livelihood. And that's I understand that. I have a livelihood that I care about as well. The cathartic way that I said it before is, you know, if your business model in the 21st century depends on killing an endangered species, you might want to reconsider your economic model. But I think that's, it's sort of, a lot of it has to do with just doing things differently.